Well, what's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Really excited to be joined this next half hour by my friend and now yours, Alderman Peter Burgalis. Hey, Peter, how are you?
Hi, Maggie. Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. I had the pleasure, as I mentioned last hour, of working with Peter for 2 years in my last couple of years at the county. And now you are a newly elected, newly minted alderman for the city of Milwaukee. Congratulations on your electoral win. What was it like moving from the county campaign to the city campaign? How do those stack up? Are they dramatically different?
Well, the districts are different. The 15th district for the county stretched from 43rd on Howard on the south side to 47th and Lisbon on the north side. And I think was a really great representation of the diversity of Milwaukee County. And there were all kinds of neighborhoods, all kinds of constituents, and all kinds of issues that I addressed for my constituents on the county board. But the 11th Aldermanic District is on the southwest side of Milwaukee. That runs from 27th in Oklahoma, Leon's Custard, out west all the way to 894. I know your Cops is a favorite of yours, but Leon's is the 11th Aldermanic's
Custard joint.
Exactly right. And I think it might have been a Top Chef favorite custard location too.
I was just going to say, I believe I saw Kristen, the host of Top Chef at Leon's, giving it a shout out, perhaps, which is fabulous. Little point of Maggie origin story here. My dad is from that side of town, and I believe at various times may have delivered a newspaper to Leon's. So that going way back into the vault for that one. As a city elected official, what do you think your top priorities are now?
Yeah, well, listen, I've knocked on thousands of doors and had hundreds of conversations with constituents, and there's a very consistent theme throughout, frankly, not just the 11th Aldermanic District, but throughout the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, where I've met residents and constituents. The primary focus, the top priority, is always public safety. Reckless driving is a problem. And if you don't feel safe in your community, if you don't feel safe in your neighborhood, you're not going to stay, assuming you have the resources to relocate. And I think it's government's obligation and responsibility to make sure that not just actual safety, but the perception of safety is improved in every neighborhood. Now, we've heard from the police department that violent crime is down 30% this year compared to last year, which is a huge, huge win for Mayor Johnson and for the entire city of Milwaukee. But it's still just a 30% improvement. We have a long way to go.
So when it comes to public safety, short of spending a lot of money for new police officers, how do we improve public safety overall? How do we combat the reckless driving problem?
Yeah, and former Alderman Murphy's Reckless Driving Task Force, which I sat in on a couple times when I was campaigning years back before COVID, came up with three different policy focus areas. First, enforcement. Obviously, you need to have the resources to have law enforcement enforce the laws and our judicial system hold people accountable when they don't follow the laws. Infrastructure investments and engineering and making our streets safer is something that the city's really taken advantage of the last couple of years with influx of federal dollars to make our streets physically safer and make it more difficult for reckless drivers to do what they're doing or what they want to do. That investment started in the most problematic neighborhoods, most problematic streets, mostly on the north side, but it's also coming to Lapham shortly and through the rest of the south side as well. But we don't just have local roads in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. A number of our most traveled and our worst reckless driving roads are state highways, Capitol Drive, Fond du Lac Avenue. The state is also starting to make those investments that will help move the needle. So the third part is education. And, the rhetoric that we hear on in a lot of media is that young people don't care, don't know how to drive, they haven't had the education for driver's ed in high school. And that's absolutely true. But kids aren't, young people aren't the only people that are driving recklessly in our community. And I think it's important to understand that there's a significant portion of our community that just doesn't care about their neighbors and their impacts of what they're doing. Commuting to downtown now, it's tough when you see a car run a red light or cut somebody off. But I think by far the vast majority of people out on the roads recognize that you have to be defensive and you have to be aware of your surroundings. And people now actively check left and right when they enter an intersection at a green light, which unfortunately is something you have to do to keep yourself safe.
Yeah, I'm certainly one of those folks. Never used to commute that far to work. I was very blessed to always live within, you know, 5 to 10, maybe at the outside 15 minutes of my workplace. Now commuting nearly 30 to 45 minutes each way, and certainly much more aware of everything that's happening, especially during those rush hour commute periods. We talked
about
Wouldn't
it be great if there was light rail that could get you to Waukesha in 12 minutes from downtown?
Wouldn't that be amazing? I even looked, and you'd be shocked to find this out, Peter. I looked for a direct bus route from downtown Milwaukee to Waukesha County. Guess what I found? It's the most interesting thing. I've talked about it before. There are buses that go directly from downtown Milwaukee to downtown Waukesha, but they only run from 3 to about 6 o'clock at night. Isn't that odd? It's just the bus route taking people from the jobs in the city back to their homes in Waukesha. There's no from the city of Milwaukee out to jobs in Waukesha County. There's no morning bus routes that go directly from the city of Milwaukee out to Waukesha. Well, really strange.
You could take that new Connect One, the BRT out to Fraidert, and connect to Waukesha Route One. That'll take you there. It'll take some time, but it is doable.
I mean it somewhat with a little bit of blithe commentary there, but that is a Waukesha County transit bus that runs from the city back out to Waukesha at the end of the business day. I just found it an interesting point of observation that there isn't one taking city folks out to Waukesha for work in the mornings. I mean, you know, just, I don't know, maybe an oversight by Waukesha County Transit. But yes, I have been checking out the BRT system, really excited to see that there is, in fact, a way to get out there with some efficiency. So my thanks to County Executive Crowley and all of you supervisors from the last administration that helped get that done. I certainly appreciate it, and I think a lot of commuters do. We talked a little bit about enforcement when it comes to reckless driving. This has been like a huge area of debate, including what the penalties should be. In fact, there's an op-ed that ran today in the Journal Sentinel forwarding an argument for mandatory minimum penalties for reckless driving. Do you think that we need to be looking at the penalties for reckless driving and increasing those? When we say enforcement, do we mean more police? Is it all of the above?
There's never going to be a magic wand solution to any problem that government's working on, right? And if there was, we'd already have fixed it. Reckless driving has a lot of components to it, but enforcement absolutely has to be a motivating factor to change behavior undesirable behavior. You know, the carrot can work in some cases, but if it doesn't, then you bring out the stick. And, you know, there are certainly disparate impact considerations for stronger enforcement and reckless driving. But neighbors and constituents that I've talked to see that as a balancing, as something as a need that needs to be balanced. Is public safety more important, or is a disparate impact more important? It's tough. But if cars are driven recklessly, they shouldn't be on the road. There's a lot of fanfare about having an update to state code that said that if you're driving recklessly and you're unregistered, the car can be towed. I would argue that it would be appropriate to tow a car if you're driving recklessly or if you're unregistered. That kind of heightened ability for law enforcement to do their job is something that we need to really discuss more at the state level so that the state legislature can give us that consideration. We have infrastructure all over Milwaukee County that's already in place that watches cars drive through red lights every single day. We know red light cameras are not allowed per Wisconsin state law yet, right? But our Milwaukee County transit buses have four cameras on the outside, high definition cameras on the outside of each and every bus. So about 250 buses on the road every day, 1,000 eyes watching traffic throughout Milwaukee County every single day. Law enforcement uses that video footage for their needs and make requests to MCTS about 300 times a year, which is incredibly significant. And it's freely provided to help with law enforcement investigations. But no one's looking at the camera footage when the operator sees someone run a red light. I think it's time to correct the narrative, change the narrative, and start taking a proactive approach to enforcement and using infrastructure and resources we already have, and having a law enforcement officer review footage that a bus operator, bus driver can mark and say, hey, a car just ran the red light. We're not going to see every single license plate. We're not going to see every single driver behind the wheel, but it's going to move the needle a little bit, and it's worth at least a try and a pilot. It's worth at least trying out and having a pilot program.
Heard. One of the interesting things that I think everyone's struggling with a bit is disparate impact. What I was a bit surprised to find out is that there is no mandated collection of data, either of, for example, the Department of Neighborhood Services or municipal court judges or judges in the state in circuit court handling criminal cases, that tracks demographic data about the defendants or parties that appear before them, bond decisions that are made, or the bail decisions that are made, and or sentencing decisions. I'm going to ask you about that after these very brief messages. Don't go anywhere, anybody. I'm talking to Peter Bergelis, a newly minted Common Council member for the City of Milwaukee, former Milwaukee County Supervisor, and a friend of mine, now a friend of yours. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Joined this half hour by Alderman Peter Bergelis of the City of Milwaukee, former Milwaukee County Supervisor. We were talking before the break about reckless driving and about increased enforcement. One of our regular listeners pointing out that penalties for reckless driving and sentences often reach up to the 12 to 15 years in prison if they cause the death of another, which is fairly commensurate with what shooting cases get sentenced at. So there's been tough enforcement for the most egregious reckless driving. And we were exploring also sort of the disparate impact question. As I think many recognize, human beings have innate biases. And one of the things that I've been really shocked about as an attorney and working in both city and county government for nearly 15 years is the fact that there's no state requirement that state court judges keep track of. There's no record keeping of any type that tracks the demographics of defendants and sentences or bail decisions that are made. There's no requirement within municipal court, which is a system controlled by the City of Milwaukee, when we look at penalties for various municipal ordinance violations. Don't you think that's something that we might want to do to help our judges and our magistrates understand more how they are, frankly, sentencing or treating different parties that appear before them over a period of time for similar either ordinance violations or criminal charges?
I think that's a great idea, Maggie, and not just charge by charge, but judge to judge, right?
Exactly.
And you know, Molly Gina in our municipal body right now has spent a career in that courtroom helping defendants be walked through the justice process fairly. And now, you know, there are, I think, plenty of opportunities to make sure and measure the impact of decisions across not just municipal court, but circuit court as well. We have dashboards at the city and at the county for human resources, for hiring and retention, department by department, and experience level and pay grade. We absolutely should be looking at and measuring the performance of our justice system. That's something that I don't think would be a wouldn't be a huge lift to do. And I really appreciate that suggestion, because it seems to me, just thinking about it for the last couple of minutes during the break, it's absolutely doable.
It's one of those things. I'm a data wonk. You know this from working with me. I always want to ask, like, does this work? Do we have data that helps those in positions of decision-making authority help understand how they're making those decisions? And again, I was just one of those things as a lawyer and somebody that worked in government, I was shocked to find out, oh my gosh, we're not tracking that. And of course, municipal court, something that the city can control, I think would be a great place to start with some of that baseline data to help us all understand, hey, are we seeing some sorts of bias show up in how different parties are treated in our justice system? And more importantly, if they're not, hey, bully for us and bully for the judges that aren't displaying that kind of bias. And of course, we all understand that penalties are usually quite specified given the facts of an individual case, which makes the question of municipal court even more appropriate, because oftentimes the municipal violations are very straightforward. It also brings me to a question that I've been dying to ask someone for a while, which is about how we in the city of Milwaukee and in other cities, towns, and villages throughout the state handle things like parking citations or multiple parking citations. We can all, I think, agree that for someone who's extremely wealthy, it's no big deal to, you know, wait a few months, have their lawyer call up the city ordinance to municipal court and say, I've got all these parking citations. What do I owe? Write a check and off they go. No deterrent effect at all whatsoever. Yet for someone who may be living paycheck to paycheck or having trouble maintaining insurance on their automobile, those difficult things that maintaining a driver's license can become, right? A couple of parking tickets can be absolutely devastating. You end up losing your license. You end up with hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars in fines and penalties. When for that person, it becomes existential, whereas for a rich person, it's not much of a deterrent at all. I've always wondered, hey, what if we had an option for especially things like parking citations that gave people the option, if they could, to engage in community service or other sort of community wellness supporting activities in lieu of that's an option that's different from paying a fine. And frankly, if people have tax returns where they're very, very wealthy, maybe a little community service might dissuade them from parking in the handicap stall to begin with. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah. And I think the city attorney's office, and if you would benefit from that kind of wouldn't call it a diversion program, but a collaborative compromise effort or agreement, you would probably have to take the afternoon off of work and sit and wait in municipal court to talk to the district or talk to the city attorney and eventually a judge. That can also be devastating and yes, just compound and roll the rock down the hill.
Yep. All good things to look at. We've just got a couple minutes left, Peter. I wanted to give you the opportunity. Why did you run for elected office? Why do you continue to want to be a public servant?
Thanks, Maggie. I enjoy my career. I've been a home lender for the last 19 or 20 years, and I enjoy seeing someone pass over the keys and someone reaching out and getting those keys in their hand and getting the keys to their first house, to their first home. That's personally fulfilling for me. That's why I enjoy my career, with why I've stayed as a mortgage lender for the last almost 20 years. I know I can help a lot more people and do more from City Hall and help my community more than one family at a time. And the reason I decided to jump in with both feet and run for office back for the 2020 election came down to watching my representative in City Hall vote against the ordinance that banned gay conversion therapy. Before that vote was even done, I knew right then and there that this person may represent me in City Hall, but he certainly doesn't represent my values. And when elections don't go your way, you can do one of three things. You can post something dumb on social media and try to feel better about yourself. You can encourage your friends to vote a different way next time around, or you put your boots on and run. And I did the third. I probably did the first two as well. But running for office isn't for the light of heart. It's not for the thin skinned. It's absolutely a job, but it's absolutely worthwhile to make your community a better place.
Thanks so much. My guest this half hour, Alderman Peter Bogalis from the City of Milwaukee. Thanks, Peter. I look forward to having you back soon. When we come back here on the Maggie Don Show, I'm going to be talking about Donald Trump's Supreme Court wish list for his second term, something to be afraid of indeed. Stay tuned, everybody. Your farm update is next here on the Civic Media Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. If you're of a certain age, you probably know that's Four Non-Blondes. What's up? That's what you just heard coming back. Little funny side note. I did an interpretive dance to that song when I was in high school. I'm a little embarrassed to say, but truth be told, gotta share the interpretive dance. I had a great theater teacher. It was all very above board. It wasn't, you know, out of nowhere. It was an assignment, but yes, that was my chosen interpretive dance music back in the early 90s. My great thanks to my guest the last half hour, City of Milwaukee Alderman Peter Bogalis. Thanks much, Peter. We have a caller just wanting to see Greg from Waukesha. This is Maggie. What do you have to say this afternoon?
Hey, Maggie, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. Nice to hear from you again, Greg.
Hey, and I loved hearing the Four Non-Blondes. For a music bed might be Indigo Girls. I love the Indigo Girls. So maybe you can add that into one of your shows. Hey, I do listen a lot, and I listen as you interview these political candidates for office, and I think that's great that we hear who we're electing and things like that. A question I wonder if you wouldn't mind entertaining is what are these candidates going to do for people like me, people with a disability? And I don't just mean noticeable disabilities like I have in my total blindness. People can see the red and white cane, but I personally believe that there's a lot of even voter suppression sometimes within the disabled community. There's a lot of, we're not including you in the electoral process. So that's my thing that I wondered if you could ask, you know, your guests in the future. And I would be more than willing, and this goes for you, this goes to any of the civic media hosts, to call in and talk about, you know, disability and things like that. So that would be great, Maggie. Thank you.
Greg, thank you so much. Kelvin, if you wouldn't mind getting Greg's number and contact information, I'd love to reach out. Greg, it would be my pleasure to ask any and every elected official that I talk with, what they're going to do to ensure that the franchise, the voting rights of folks in our disabled communities aren't impaired or in any other way limited by so-called election integrity legislation that has been proposed. I have been personally shocked by a lot of the cold-hearted rhetoric that I have heard, especially from Senate candidate Eric Hovde, who had the audacity to suggest those in nursing and rehabilitation facilities really don't need to be voting because they'll be dead soon, was effectively what he said. I'm getting the quote wrong, so apologies, but that was the upshot of what he seemed to suggest. It's appalling. And I think there's a tenor and a tone about various legislation that is proposed. And again, we have to ask ourselves, what's the value being expressed here? If someone says, well, this is about election integrity. Well, if what you say is about election integrity makes it more difficult, in some cases nearly impossible, for elderly people or students or people with disabilities to exercise their constitutionally guaranteed right to vote, what is that really about? So, Greg, you raise an absolutely excellent point. We'll have Calvin chat with you. I would love to have you on the show as a guest to talk about this in more detail. Thanks for listening, Greg. You take care. Before the break, I shared with all of you that I wanted to talk a bit about what Trump's potential next term could mean for our federal courts and for your rights, your children's rights and freedoms, for mine and for people like Greg's, our friends and neighbors and family. I think it's really important to kind of put what we're talking about in context. Let's just start with the Supreme Court. Currently, the Supreme Court has 3 Democratic appointees out of 9 justices. That means that it's overweighted by a 2-to-1 margin with Republicans. Now, one could ask, well, if Republicans won way more presidential elections than Democrats did, you would expect a heavier weight. Well, those 9 justices were appointed over the course of 5 Democratic administrations and 4 Republican administrations. So there's been more Democratic presidents than there have been Republican presidents, and yet the court is weighted 2-to-1 in favor of Republican appointees. That doesn't seem to be very fair. Certainly doesn't seem to be democratic in that the court should reflect the will of the voters to a certain extent as expressed in our presidential election cycles. And the problem is only more exacerbated when you start looking at federal appeals and district courts. For example, the 5th Circuit Court of Appeals, which I have talked about many times on the show and likely will again tomorrow, because they are simply just off the charts in terms of bad decisions and clearly politicized decision making. The 5th Circuit has 17 judges on it. Only 5 of them were appointed by Democratic presidents. If we look to the 6th Circuit Court of Appeals, there's 16 judges on that court. Only 6 of them were appointed by Democratic presidents. The 8th Circuit, there's 11 judges on the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, and only one. Excuse me, there's 11 judges on the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, and only one of them was appointed by a Democratic president. Say what? That doesn't even make any sense to me, that you would have courts so unbalanced. Now, in the interest of fairness, I'll call out that the 1st Circuit Court of Appeals doesn't have a single Republican-appointed judge. That's a problem, too. But if we compare the amount of nominees that were confirmed that Donald Trump was able to push through, and we compare it to President Obama or even President Biden, Trump was able to get confirmed many more judges than either Obama or President Biden. And the scariest part isn't just the numbers here. President Trump appointed more judges considered by the American Bar Association to be unqualified than any other president. I'm going to repeat that. President Trump appointed more judges successfully to the federal courts that were deemed unqualified by the American Bar Association than any other president. By the way, for the ABA to rate a judicial appointee unqualified, you basically have to not be able to add as a lawyer. I'm being a little bit glib by that measure, but not much. It's extraordinarily rare for the American Bar Association to rate a judicial appointee unqualified. Now, largely that's been because presidents do a damn good job of vetting their federal appointees. But those norms, those constraints that have applied for decades simply weren't followed by Donald Trump. And as a result, we have more inexperienced and more unqualified judges than ever before that will serve lifetime appointments in the federal judiciary. And the prospect of Donald Trump appointing more justices to the Supreme Court if he wins this year is stark. Justice Clarence Thomas will be over 80 by the time the next president takes office. Samuel Alito, two of the arch conservatives on the court, he'll be approaching 80 years old. So there is likely to be at least one, if not two, Supreme Court vacancies during the term of the next president. There's also been discussions of Justice Sotomayor, who's also getting up there in age, and whether she should retire now to allow President Biden to appoint her, especially given the Democrats' current Senate majority. But all of this should tell us this really matters. It mattered in 2016. I made this argument many times that, listen, if you care about freedoms, if you care about being equal under the law, then there was only one reasonable vote to make back in 2016. And we have now reaped the rewards of people who refuse to take on the adult responsibility of casting a vote between two imperfect choices in 2016. The right for women to be full citizens on equal footing with men in this country has been eroded, and eroded because people couldn't find their way to making what could be considered a difficult choice in 2016 between two deeply imperfect candidates. Women have fewer rights now than they did in 2016 because people weren't willing to make that choice. We find ourselves here yet again, as if Trump hasn't done enough to destroy our federal judiciary. Jack from Merrimack, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Thank you for taking my call. We know why this imbalance is the case. First thing is that McConnell spent 6 out of the 8 years that Obama was president obstructing every single judicial candidate and appointee that he possibly could. And he slowed that process down just as soon as Trump got in. They went wildfire. They just started dropping rules and decreasing time limits, so that more and more of these unqualified judges could be successfully appointed. Second thing.
We're losing you a little bit, Jack. Sorry about that. He wasn't coming through real clear. But Jack's entirely correct. I've talked at length on this show about the fact that the Supreme Court is currently constituted is exercising more powers than we've seen ever in the history of this country, largely unchecked by Congress and unchecked internally by having ideological balance within the court itself. That's a problem. That's not good for democracy, and it's not good for you or me. If we consider that the very idea that a president is now considered to be, at least to some certain extent, a king immune from our criminal legal system in this country, which is bound to be the determination of at least the 5 conservative men on the court today, boy, I didn't think we'd end up here. This is incredibly dangerous. Unless we all forget, Donald Trump promised us exactly the sorts of judges he would appoint repeatedly. He has taken credit repeatedly, time and time again, for the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Don't think that he won't do this again. He took his list, his short list of judicial candidates, directly from the Federalist Society, his first go-around. And there's already a list out there from a group called, let's see here, I want to get this exactly right, from a group called the Center for Judicial Renewal, that is the legal arm of the American Family Association. It put out its short list. It includes some absolute humdingers of potential judicial appointees. But perhaps this one might be one of my favorite ones. Morris Tan is on the short list from that group. After the official Dobbs opinion overturning Roe v. Wade was released, Tan was interviewed on a podcast where he said this: when you're talking about something like 63 million lives of innocent unborn babies that have been snuffed out since 1973, this makes the Holocaust look small by comparison. Thank you, Morris Tan. Yes, the Holocaust is equivalent to women having coextensive right to control their bodies. That's it for this Tuesday edition. I'm Maggie Dawn. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but always remember, it's better when we stand together.
Great big healer of hope for a destination. I'm telling these tears, go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flame.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. Thought it was done. Not quite done yet. We have a whole other segment together. So, so very glad. Been talking about the Center for Judicial Renewal, the legal arm of the American Family Association, just put out its recommended list of potential Trump appointees to the federal judiciary. And boy, is it loaded with some clunkers. Mentioned just before the break, Morris Tan, who paralleled abortion and the Holocaust. Yeah, that's a guy I want on the federal judiciary, don't you think? I mean, incredibly offensive. Other shortlists from the Center for Judicial Renewal include James Ho. Now, James Ho, if you forget who this guy is, before he became a judge for the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, he was the guy that wrote the torture memo. That's who James Ho is. The one who said, oh, no, this is all just enhanced interrogation. No violation of the Geneva Convention. This isn't torture, waterboarding, stripping, putting people in rooms without sleep for days on end with bright blinking lights, heavy metal music, and dogs barking at him. Not torture, you know, a little dash of waterboarding. That's who James Ho is. James Ho is, of course, on the short list. By the way, he's been sort of on a publicity tour of such, busy signing letters to law schools like Yale and Columbia, telling them that he'll never hire anyone from Columbia or Yale as one of his clerks. Another one on the short list from the Center for Judicial Renewal is a judge by the name of Lawrence Van Dyke. He's one of the ones that the American Bar Association said was completely unqualified to be a federal judge. Here's what one commentator said about Lawrence Van Dyke's style as a lawyer and judge. I'm quoting here: arrogant, lazy, an ideologue, and lacking in the knowledge necessary for the day-to-day practice of law, including procedural rules. In case you missed any of that, arrogant, lazy, and ideologue, and lacking in knowledge of the day-to-day practice of law, including procedural rules. Well, that sounds just like a perfect person to become a lifetime federal judge. Don't worry, Donald Trump made him one. Ta-da! I mean, holy cow. Interestingly enough, also on the list is another guy that I would also say sounds arrogant, lazy, and ideologue. This is a new federal judge under Donald Trump that the Center for Judicial Renewal says Donald Trump should put on the Supreme Court. There's a guy by the name of Stuart Kyle Duncan. Now, if you've never heard of this guy, let me help you out here, because he went to Stanford Law School, guest of the Federalist Society, to talk to a bunch of law school students. They started asking him some pretty challenging questions about a couple of the opinions he wrote. And he literally would not tolerate their questions. Kelvin, I think we got a little sound from Kyle Duncan taking questions at Stanford Law School. Let's take a listen. This is Cut 5.
Not persuaded.
It makes sense. Can
Super.
You explain
Great. Good. Next question.
I did read it just before this, and I'm confused how that squares with what you said about being respectful of people when you're talking about, like...
Yeah, I thought my opinion was perfectly respectful. I gave reasons. That's what judges do. I gave reasons.
It's a slippery slope argument about, like, using a bunch of different pronouns and what could happen if you chose a specific...
Yeah, I was talking about... you read the opinion.
But
next question.
But you didn't answer my question, which is, like, why did you think that you couldn't be respectful to one litigant without somehow causing downstream effects?
For the reasons that I gave in the opinion. Thanks.
How about you give it to us?
Next question. How about you ask me a question?
We did.
Yeah, okay.
How about you give
them
to us?
Next question. All right. Well, look, thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me. As far as the rest of you people, whatever.
I know that was a little hard to hear. I will help you out. There is a law student asking him about a particular opinion that he wrote in response to Stuart Kyle Duncan telling these students that it's essential to be respectful of litigants. And one of the students brought up a decision that he had written where he basically engaged in personal insults towards one of the litigants. And so the student very ably asked the judge to square what he just told them about being respectful with the language that he used in an opinion, basically personally attacking one of the litigants. And if you caught this, what Stuart Kyle Duncan says to this group of Stanford law students is, I gave reasons. They're in the opinion. That's what judges do. I gave them reasons. And when the students press him to try to bring these two things into some sort of, I don't know, sensible unity, he basically just keeps saying next question and then concludes his speech while saying thanks to the Federalist Society for having me, but to all you other people. This is a federal court judge being asked questions by students. If you can't answer students who are calling you out about the inconsistencies in your, I hate to even call it this, judicial philosophy, you have no business being on the federal bench. If a law student can verbally spar with you to the place that you're like, I wrote down my reasons, read you, I wrote down the reasons, and that's good enough, you don't deserve to be on the bench. I'll talk more about a few of these judges on the shortlist tomorrow because it's really bad. And this is what a second Trump presidency promises. These are people already on the federal bench for the rest of their lives. These are the sorts of small-minded, thin-skinned, not deep thinkers that Donald Trump would elevate to the Supreme Court. Why? Because they'll do his bidding. Because they wouldn't be judicially independent. They wouldn't engage in deep thinking or deep legal analysis. They would simply just trumpet back out the results that Donald Trump and the Federalist Society and lobbying groups want. This isn't what we want in our judicial system. It isn't what justice looks like. It isn't what equal treatment under the law looks like. It's both intellectually lazy and morally reprehensible, and we all should be very afraid because those appointees sit for their lifetime, even though Donald Trump may only serve another term for 4 years. Now it's actually it for this Tuesday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together. Devil's advocates are next.